Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Jay. So, you know, I thought today we would start off just by jumping right into some listener comments, questions, critiques, gripes, whatever you want to call them. Okay, so let's start with Stuart from London. That's London in the actual UK. There are some Londons in the United States, and one in Canada, I think.
One is London, Ohio. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
So, not as nice.
This is the real London, certainly. As I'll call it that. I don't know, the first one maybe. Anyway, Stuart writes: is the way the U.S. government set up with various powers allocated to the branches more complex than, say, the U.K. set up, or does it just seem that way? Because it's a non-U.S. citizen, I haven't grown up with it.
I don't know. I think maybe it is. My understanding of the English form of government is based on some college classes I took 20 years ago. I can't swear to have any sort of real expertise on how the UK government works, but I'll tell you that sure sounds complicated to me. Where you've got a parliament and you elect people by party, and then the speaker is sort of the prime minister, who's sort of like the president, and then you got a queen, and then there's the EU, and it's a whole big thing. So I think part of it might just be what you grow up with. The other piece, I guess, is that the British have an unwritten constitution, as opposed to the U.S., which has a written one, which to me, the written one seems kind of easier to go with because you can just look stuff up. But again, that may just be the what I'm used to talking. So,
yeah, and I think that's partly it. I would agree with you, but I guess I would be a little more comfortable saying that I think, generally speaking, parliamentary systems are a little less complex, actually, a little more streamlined in certain ways. And I think, to my mind, a little more, I would say, sensible, almost. And so I think that I understand, at least I think I understand, some of the reasons why we chose not to go with a parliamentary system in the United States. But I think that was a mistake on the part of the framers, and I think we would have been better served with a system like that, though, who the heck knows, but that's kind of my take on that. So,
yeah, and something that's important to remember, so much of a parliamentary system is based on parties and coalitions and factions and so forth. And the American founders didn't expect or didn't think or just hoped that we wouldn't have that sort of party or factionalism. There's no mention in the U.S. Constitution of parties or anything like that. And the idea was that, your representatives would just represent you, and the representatives of the states would represent the states. And I guess it was naive on the part of the founders to think that you wouldn't have a partisan system evolve. And again, a partisan system evolved pretty quickly, like within the first, 8 years, we had a partisanship. So I think that is maybe a difference of, why we didn't go with a parliamentary system. Although, thinking back, it's sort of, in some ways, there was deference to the state legislatures to set themselves up however they liked. I guess that's just kind of my historical note as to,
sure,
to why we don't have a parliamentary system.
Yeah. Yep. Big mistake. Say too bad, but it's not like we're going to change it anytime soon. So Stuart's second question writes, Mike's comments on the various attempts by states to make it harder to make boundary changes is a good thing struck me as strange. How, given all the gerrymandering that has come before, would this be anything but setting an advance for one party or the other in stone without attempting to redraw boundaries in a more logical manner first? And so I think, you know, what Stuart's talking about here is gerrymandering. And so, I mean, to me, the issue here, and we've seen a number of states move toward this, is toward some sort of a bipartisan or at least less partisan
commission.
Yeah. And, sort of, yes. And I should say, I could see where you'd say, well, if this is being done by the powers that be, if I understand the question correctly, and Stuart, if I'm misunderstanding your question, just write in and let me know. But that essentially, if these folks are doing this, wouldn't this basically just be cementing in an advantage for them? And I would say, well, yeah, if the legislature passed this stuff, but in a lot of cases, what we're seeing is that these things are happening through ballot initiatives, and legislatures are actually resisting these things, because the reason they're happening through ballot initiatives is because the people are feeling like the legislature are being partisan and trying to set advantages in stone. And that, to me, is one of the positives of this, is that one of the sort of catch-22s of institutional reform is that oftentimes, almost all the time, you're asking the people in power to change institutional arrangements that benefit them, because it's what got them and keeps them in power. And that, I think, it can be the advantage of ballot initiatives and direct democracy. Now, there's certainly a downside. All kinds of crazy stuff can get passed, potentially. We've talked about that in the past. But I think a lot of times, if it's done in this manner, it actually can work. That's not to say it always does. There are issues with ballot initiatives, certainly. But that's kind of my take on this. Jay?
I think Stuart kind of hits it on the head a little bit in that, look, redistricting, no matter what, is an inherently political decision. And the U.S. Constitution recognized that. And I think the response is, and so necessarily it's the people who are in power who are going to be drawing those districts. Just because who else is going to do it? I mean, you're exactly right. It's a catch-22. But the other piece of this is that, you know, we have redistricts are drawn every 10 years. And that's for a lot of good reasons, like there's shifts in population. There are changes in attitudes. There are, just changes in I suppose I already said that population. But it's also a good thing because the Constitution says that's what you have to do. So I think there's always this opportunity to continue to redraw. And if there are, you want to say one party overreaches, then the next party can sort of try to even it out next time around. The other part of this that I think is so often overlooked is it's sort of a game that a lot of times there's a lot of bipartisan cooperation in drawing these districts, and it's, you know, maybe doesn't play out that way, but there are plenty of, say you are and I'm going to use my state of Ohio as an example, which tends to be a Republican state, Republican leaning. But we have strong Democratic contingencies in the big cities and certainly Northern Ohio, as opposed to Southern Ohio, is more Republican. So there are a lot of these representatives who are perfectly happy to draw a district that will be a Democrat, and they'll be happy to protect their own seat, even if that means giving up another seat to a Republican. There are deals that are struck. For example, the district I live in is absolutely crazy shaped. It's called referred to as the snake on the lake because it runs sort of across the Lake Erie shore. All the way from Cleveland to Toledo, the west side of Cleveland to Toledo. So my congressperson is from Toledo, which is about 2 hours away, and really a different city, a different place altogether than where I'm from. But part of that district was drawn because, well, they're going to lose a seat, and the Democrats decided they wanted to draw out Representative Dennis Kucinich for a number of reasons, one of which he's nuts. He was sort of a thorn in the Democrat party's side. So they said, look, if we're going to lose a seat, let's go ahead and make this deal, have this weird shaped district that's still going to be a Democrat district, but he won't be in it. So, you know, that stuff happens, and it doesn't affect the bigger picture you know, how seats get drawn and how many, you know, whatever, left-leaning, right-leaning. And I would say almost it's there's sort of a idea that parties like to draw seats that are easily winnable, either side, because again, it's that predictability, right? So that any given election in the state, for example, state legislature, can come down to sort of like, you know, a handful, 10, 15 races out of 99 in Ohio. So I think that's, I think there's a lot, there are wheels within wheels within wheels in this stuff, but it is inherently a political decision. There are always deals that are made. That's just kind of the way it is. And the saving grace is that it is sort of constantly being changed and reformed and reexamined.
Yeah, you know, though some people.
So what I'm saying is, I don't think there's a lot that is cast in stone. It may be cast in stone for like the next 2 years or next 4 years, but certainly not the next 10 years.
Well, maybe not. I think what some people object to about this, they say it's a difference of kind, sort of a qualitative difference, is that if you're allowed to lock in your own electorate, then you can actually, this can kind of build on itself in a way where subsequent, you know, if you overreach, the next legislature can redress that. Not necessarily the case because of the nature of what we're talking about here. The other thing I would add to this is, you know, some have said, well, there's a simple way around all this, and it doesn't have to do with bipartisan commissions or anything like that. It has to do with eliminating single member districts, meaning that, for instance, Ohio has 16 members of the House of Representatives, and that's, of course, based on population, and right. That it would just basically be you'd elect 16 people to run at large. And
which
so
would be sort of like a parliamentary system.
Exactly.
Which you know, like.
Going back to that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's something to be said for that. Now, I'm not saying that we should just, you know, go ahead and try that, but there's nothing that would constitutionally prohibit a state right. from
Are
doing
there any
that.
States that do that now?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I thought there was maybe somebody like some goofy New England state that had like, considering something like that.
Not that I'm aware of, no. But I mean, it would be an interesting experiment, certainly. We've seen it. I mean, certain governments do it. We see it a lot with city governments and that sort of thing with at large seats. And there are pros and cons, certainly. And the Birkin in me would say I'm not necessarily crazy about just switching to the system and let's see what happens.
Right. But well, and you would say, look, the interests of a place where I live, Northeastern Ohio, is in the issues involved in Northeastern Ohio are different than a lot of the issues where you live, Southwestern Ohio.
Yeah.
It's different constituencies, it's different people, it's different industries, it's all that. And I think there's a good argument that you would have a different representative from that area.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not saying, well, this is clearly a superior thing. There are certain advantages and disadvantages and that sort of thing. So yeah. All right, well, let's move on. Johnny writes, in high school, I read a book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. And recently, in my U.S. presidency course, we read a piece about the psychological underpinnings of personal party alignment. The idea is basically this. People have, whether born with or socialized, a few basic morals. Democrats and Republicans attract people based on certain fundamental morals that the parties emphasize. The Democrats are essentially mobilized through notions of equality, regardless of nationality or class. Republicans focus more on a sense of loyalty to group, whether that's family or country or both, and respect for authority. I always think about this when discussions about political disagreements occur, and it almost always applies, in my opinion. Do you think this is true? Jay?
I'd say no. I haven't read either of those books, so it's probably, you know, not fair of me just kind of jumping in, because the arguments may be, you know, really well laid out, and if I read them, I might think differently. But you know, my sense is that there we are sort of socialized into our parties, but it's even less a thing of we identify with particular values. In some ways, I think we identify with the same values, but we just call them different things. I would disagree sort of pretty vehemently that the Republicans believe in sort of a group identity. I guess that's, and I'm not sure. Well, again, I guess I'm not sure what exactly you mean by that. Yeah,
I can speak to that because I've read the book. I'm a big fan of it. I've actually used parts of it in my classes. And so essentially what Moral Foundations theory, and this is what Johnny's talking about, is I think it's really fascinating. And it's based on this sort of cross-cultural massive series of surveys that Jonathan Haidt and other research groups have done. And what they found is that their argument is that based on this research, there are essentially five foundations of morality, if you will. And the five foundations are, the first one is care, that's kind of protecting other folks. The second is fairness or proportionality, kind of the justice thing. The third is loyalty to group. The fourth is authority or respect. And the fifth is sanctity or purity. It's kind of like, you know, certain things are disgusting or wrong,
right,
or that kind of
right.
thing. And what they found is that people who identify as conservatives pretty much adhere to these things or believe in the importance of these things more or less equally. But people who see themselves as liberals put a lot more emphasis on those first two things, the care and the equality thing. And that's my understanding of it. And I think actually I've looked at the data behind this and considered the arguments. And I really think there is something to be said for that. And there's a couple ways to spin this. If you're on the right, you could say, well, see, conservatives are much more balanced than liberals are. Now, if you're on the left end of these things, as I am, you could say, well, no, that there's nothing to say that these five values are all equal in importance, and that in fact care and fairness are more important, which is why that we see these things as more important than, say, loyalty or authority, which are kind of vestiges of our tribal past, and we should try to jettison these to a certain extent. And that's kind of, I think there's maybe something to be said for that. So I think I would definitely recommend that anyone who hasn't picked up The Righteous Mind, and that's the book where Haidt lays out this theory, it's a great book, well worth reading. It definitely changed a lot in the way that I look at politics. And so I give it a huge thumbs up and a big recommendation.
Okay. Well, I will check it out. I would add one other piece to that, though, is, and again, maybe it's sort of a different expectation of, where we align ourselves morally, but a lot of what I expect out of my government has nothing to do with morality, with things like just getting the job done. For example, keeping the country safe, paving the roads, filling the potholes, preserving a strong economy. Those aren't necessarily moral values, right? It's just you're looking at this as, here are the deliverables I want from my government. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that just doesn't figure into Haidt's analysis, but I will check out the book.
All right. Let's see. Our next question here is from Eric, who wrote in on our website, politicsguys.com. You can do that in the comments. And sometimes we have all sorts of interesting things going on in the comments section. He wrote in with a link as well as a question for you, Jay.
Oh, boy. Okay.
All right. Eric writes after the link, in this November 10th Miami Herald article, the one Jay continues to cite as his source and justification for stating repeatedly and erroneously that ballots were found in an airport rental car, be careful, Jay may be slandering the author if he continues to purposefully mischaracterize his work. You will note the article is titled, "No, These Ballot Boxes Found in Broward Don't Contain Votes, Officials Say," and was published a full 7 days before Jay went on to cite it or another article to push his right-wing agenda. Please issue a retraction or cite the mysterious article published right before you went to air from the same newspaper that apparently said the complete opposite. Like I said, Jay is right-wing, disingenuous, or both. I'm sure he's a great guy to grab a beer with, but it is a full-time job keeping up with his squirrely relationship with the facts and refusal to Google his own punditry. Otherwise, I love the show. Warmest regards, Eric.
Well, I'd have to take a look at the link that Eric sent. But I will do that. If I am wrong, I will issue a correction. But I think there is still some some concern as to ballots being found in rental cars at the airport. And we've yet to hear an explanation as to how that happened or how that's a normal thing to have happened. And I think the rest of the history of the Snipes administration there in Broward County speaks volumes as to how the elections have been conducted there. And I guess it strikes me as odd. The initial response is always like, "No, you're lying." Is this conservative spin? Again, there are court documents about her improperly destroying ballots, improperly releasing results. This is not new. This has been determined by the appropriate legal system. So I will take a look, but correction is due, I will make it.
Okay. So I think there are two issues here. There's first the simple factual, well, I don't know how simple the factual issue is, but whether or not this in fact was an incorrect story that you might have seen. And that's one issue. The bigger issue, I think, to my sense, from what I'm hearing, is your argument that there's just some, generally speaking, even if regardless of what this story is, there are broader problems with the administration of the election system under Snipes, and that wouldn't necessarily be affected one way or the other to a significant degree by whatever this specific incident
right,
is.
Right. I mean, that's, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, for example, the question, why wasn't there the real-time reporting that you got from every other, county in Florida and in the nation, right? I mean, how is it that everyone else can do this, but Broward County can't? And then you can say, well, it's resources. But again, I think it's sort of hard to believe that this lack of resources falls so particularly on Broward County as opposed to the rest of the nation.
Yeah, and I think actually that this is maybe a little more widespread, Jay. I'll be a little more negative here, but that we tend to see a lot more in close races, because it's a spotlight is put on that sort of thing. And I feel like lack of resources, I've mentioned this before, is a big thing. And I taught a class this semester on public policy. And one of the things that we wrapped up the semester with was a discussion of vote fraud, voting security policy, that sort of thing, elections policy. And I did some kind of back of the envelope type calculations. And for the low cost of, a couple billion dollars, which, in federal budget terms is almost nothing, we could do an awful lot to bring resources up to a level which would make a lot of these problems, I would think, not entirely go away, but be a lot less to minimize these things. And it would be a pretty simple thing. The federal government does this all the time by saying, offering grants to states and county governments, and basically saying, here's this pot of money. And as long as you adopt these sort of best practices, then you have access to this. And I think that would be something I would like to see if Congress is really serious about election security and the integrity of our elections. Then they should put their money where their mouth is, because in the larger scheme of things, it's just not that much money. And it's for something that's so hugely important that I think we really need to focus much more on.
Yeah. Giving people money always improves accountability. I'll leave it at that. I'll take a look at the links and I will respond accordingly.
All right. Okay, next, Anna messaged us on our Facebook page with this comment. This is about, I said something about mandatory voting. We were talking about that, I think it was last week, and she said...
Yeah, I wasn't on that show, but that sounds like a terrible idea.
Here's what Anna has to say. If people know they should do it, they'll educate themselves and do it. It would increase engagement. She says, I don't read about car performance research until I'm about to buy a car. Saying that forcing people to vote is a checkbox thing is nonsense. Voting with an empty choice is already communicating. So essentially, the argument Anna has here is that if you tell people they have to do it, they will become more engaged, at least some of them will, and that will be a positive thing for democracy. And Jay, I think your stance on this, you've already kind of telegraphed that.
Well, I think there are all kinds of dictators throughout history who made that exact same argument, that look, if we tell people to do it, they will be much more responsive if we mandate it. My issue is it's really kind of antithetical to freedom. And my concern would be, look, the places where you've seen mandatory voting historically have been despotic places, right?
Like Australia. Australia has mandatory voting. I mean, there are a number of countries who have it, and I think there's a difference here. Is that in these cases, in these countries that have it, it's not like if you don't vote, you go to jail. It's like the equivalent of some totally minor thing, and it's essentially done just basically to emphasize that participating in democracy is not just this thing you can do if you feel like it, but it is an obligation that's expected of all citizens. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah. To me, that sort of is at odds with the very idea of democracy.
Well, I think you maybe say it's at the odds of going to moral foundations again. You know, you tend to think that, we didn't talk about this lore as part of moral foundations, but one of the things I should mention that Haidt and his researcher said is, well, we think there might be this sixth dimension, this kind of liberty dimension that so many people on the right are so incredibly hung up on, that that's the be all and end all. Yeah. And I would say, yeah, liberty is important, but, you know, there are a lot of things that are also important. And I think where the right errs so often is by making liberty the be all and the end all. And I disagree with that.
Yeah, James Madison was hung up on liberty.
Well, again, it's not a matter of not saying it's important, but it's a matter of saying that doesn't matter then more than all these other things. And I think too many people on the right seem to think that liberty is all that matters and everything else is just kind of like, well, whatever.
All right. Well, let me put it to you this way. Let's say we have mandatory voting and you say, okay, well, the penalty for not mandatorily voting is minimal. Well, why is that? If it's important, shouldn't the penalty be greater?
Well, no, not at all. I think the point of it is not so much to try to criminalize non-voting. The point of it is to enshrine in law this sort of obligation that all citizens should understand that they have.
Okay.
So, and again, but
what it's actually doing is criminalizing non-voting.
But it's not really, because it's not enforced in the same way that, say, laws against, criminal acts, felonies, other things like that sort of thing. So yeah, I think
perhaps not immediately.
Well, no, not. I mean, you know, there have been, like I said, there are a number of countries that actually have used this for a while, and it's not like there's been this slippery slope where, oh my God, Australia is just going down the tubes because they're throwing people in jail for not voting, you know, and that kind of thing. So no, I disagree. I think that might actually be a good thing, and I think Anna makes some good points.
All right.
Let's move on. Talk a little bit about.
What if you just forget to vote?
I think that, again, if it's not really criminalized or gone after, that's not so much of an issue.
So it's not, what's the mens rea, I guess? Is it a strict liability or is it a, I meant to, but I couldn't?
Yeah. And I think that's pretty much where it's sort of like, well, okay, basically, you know, it's not like freedom is being, you know, flushed down the toilet in Australia because of mandatory voting, that sort of thing.
All right.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what we're reading, listening to, what have you, that sort of thing. I don't know, Jay, do you want me to start off or do you want to start?
Yeah, you can start off.
Okay, well, Jay, I don't know if you know this, but this year, I might have mentioned this before, is the 200th anniversary of Karl Marx's birth.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
Well, you know, I knew you'd say that, but yeah. I've been thinking a lot about Marx lately and about capitalism lately. And, you know, I'm kind of one of these sort of like 1.5 cheers for capitalism sort of people. I've got a big problem with capitalism and the market. And I have for a long period of time. But the weird thing is that doesn't put me entirely in the liberal camp because I also have some pretty big problems with the state. You know, overall though, I have more problems with the market and capitalism than I do with the state for a lot of reasons. So I've been reading a little bit about Marx, and there's one great article that I read recently this week called The Inexhaustible Desire to Keep Talking About Marx. And it talks about a number of books that have recently come up. Yeah, I thought you'd like that title. And one of the quotes,
maybe it's only inexhaustible in certain segments. But,
that's true. Yeah. That's true. You don't talk about Marx.
I could quickly become exhausted.
And but. I would say much to your detriment. Now, there's one line I really love from this article said, capitalism's tragic fate is that it cannot cope with the growth it has stimulated and will be riven by crisis after crisis until eventually it collapses. I really like that line.
Was that from Marx or one of these biographers?
That is from the article that talks about a lot of these books about Marxism. In fact, there's one of these books about Marxism that sounded just fascinating to me. It's a book that just came out in 2018 called Marx and Marxism. It is now on my Amazon wish list. Part one is a look at Marx the person, kind of putting him in the context of his time. And the second part looks not just at Marxism as a philosophy, but kind of as it's actually played out from the 19th century to the present. And best of all, there are a lot of these books on Marxism I picked up that are just sort of daunting and impenetrable and incredibly long. This is much clearer, more straightforward, and best of all, it covers a lot of ground, but in only 305 pages. That's not counting, you know, the endnotes and all that sort of thing. So even if it's not something I get as a Christmas present, it's definitely something I'm probably going to end up getting myself, and I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Wow. So I guess I'd begin by noting the irony that there seems to be a market for Marxist books. And how would Marx have felt about that?
Yeah, well, you know, and I think it, you know, and again, it's, you can certainly use a straw man critique of Marx and Marxism, which a lot of people on the right love doing. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you should just say, oh, Karl Marx, ha ha ha, you know, Soviet Union, and just say, well, obviously this man had nothing useful to say. Certainly I'm not advocating Marxism.
I've said a lot of times, I've said in a lot of ways, Marx diagnosed the problem correctly, but give the wrong prescription.
Okay, yeah. And I think you and I probably would have certain grounds of agreement about that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, that prescription, when put in place, had led to the death, torture, incarceration of millions and millions of people. I mean, again, let's talk the numbers. I mean, probably 30 million under Stalin, probably close to 50 million under Mao. Probably 2 to 3 million under Pol Pot in Cambodia.
But to be fair, those are exactly the kind of societies or governments, countries in which Marx was saying that actually, no, they wouldn't be ready for that sort of thing. I mean, those were pretty, that was the philosophy that was, you know, grafted on to places that, according to what I understand to be Marx's own interpretation, it could not be correctly interpreted. So, you know, if you take something and you use it incorrectly, it's like, say, oh, there's this chainsaw, which is really useful for cutting down trees. And, oh, I cut off my arm with it. And it's really, chainsaws are bad. Well, if they're used incorrectly, yeah, absolutely they are. Yeah. So I think that's more blaming, you know, Lenin maybe, or blaming Pol Pot, but blaming the theory for the people who incorrectly use it, to me, is wrongheaded.
All right, fair enough. I am going to take sort of the farthest turn away from Marx that I can.
Okay.
And again, this is this, I know this is going to air on Wednesday, but it's still Sunday when we're recording it. I would just note the eulogies to President George Herbert Walker Bush from the funeral. If you didn't have the opportunity to see them or hear them, it's really impressive, and I think speaks to what is best about our country, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. You say I am very much the cynic all the time. Well, you're the idealist, and you may be correct, but really some fantastic speakers, particularly George W. Bush. It was sort of for me, again, kind of riveting TV. And I think it made some important statements about our country and how it was and how it is now and how it might be in the future. So that's sort of my, what I'm reading, what I'm listening to. So,
all right. Yeah,
and it'll be a good antidote after you've read all this Marx stuff.
And remember, folks, that comes from Jay, our resident cynic. So it's not a little dose of idealism for Jay. I think that's a great note to close on. So thanks everyone for listening. We really do appreciate it. And let us know what you thought. If I got my facts wrong, hey, you know, we're always interested in making sure that we're going by the facts, both Jay and I, right, Jay?
That's right.
Absolutely. We're fact-based. And we do appreciate all your comments, questions, concerns, all that kind of stuff. We'd also appreciate, if you haven't already, if you could subscribe to the show, share episodes. That helps us a whole lot. And hey, if you want to chuck in a few bucks here or there to keep the show going, that would be great too. And you can do that by going to politicsguys.com/support. If you want to get in touch with us, it's mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page. We have stuff throughout the week. Facebook.com/politicsguys. We are also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, Will Miller, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show is produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.